God, time passes fast, doesn't it?
It doesn't seem that way when you're working. It's funny. To me, it seems to take forever to write a book. I seem to be writing more slowly all the time. Or maybe it's getting more difficult. But it takes me, it seems a lifetime to deliver a book anymore.
Well, as I said before, you're getting better. Each book seems to be progressively improved and smooth and character development is sensational.
Well, this was a nice book in that I've tried a number of things here, and I find some things particularly interesting in terms of a writer. The structure of doing a book completely at sea is an interesting thing to do. It's very claustrophobic, and that either crushes you and it crushes the story, or it makes it very intense. Another thing that was interesting was to do a boat with this crew of 350 of them women. Created this, you had to create sort of a village cast off and afloat at sea. And I particularly like the characters in this book. I like the way some of these Soviet characters just came alive in a way I didn't anticipate when I began the book.
When you did Gorky Park, did you anticipate having your hero appear in a subsequent book?
No, never. And not when I ended it. Not when I finished Gorky Park. It ended so perfectly for me that you didn't know what was going to become of Arkady Renko at that point as he stands in the snow in Staten Island. And there certainly was no impulse to run out and deliver an answer. The answer came when I was thinking again of the Soviet Union, knew I couldn't get back into the country because of their antagonism towards me and towards Gorky Park. And saw this article about this boat. There was something very intriguing about a Soviet factory ship in American waters working with American trawlers. And then to find out about the boat and to find out what was the lowest possible position on a Soviet factory ship. And there the answer finally presented itself.
Well, let's work up to the slime line and the boat. Just to go back a little bit, in what way did the Soviets show their antagonism towards you after Gorky Park?
Well, the denunciations in the press calling me an anti-Soviet scum. That's an indication. That's what we call a weather vane, you know. And then, of course, people who were bringing in Gorky Park, the book was confiscated and the people were arrested. And this continued up until a couple of years ago. Suddenly, in the last 2 years, glasnost and perestroika has accelerated to the point at which this year Gorky Park is being published in the Soviet Union. There'll be an abridgment, a long abridgment in a Soviet magazine. American magazines will give you a 25-page abridgment or, you know, a slice of a book, but Soviet magazines, they always do things bigger. It's going to do an abridgment.
Are you going there for a book signing?
I was there. I thought it was
going
to come out this May. I went a month ago.
Oh, what was it like?
It was pretty fascinating.
The book is out now.
The book is not out now. It was going to be in the third edition of a magazine there. They were unhappy with their translation. They'll bring it out in September. So I missed that sort of epiphanal event of being there when my own book didn't matter. It will come out. And I'll be there again, I think, this winter.
So what? You had no problem getting into the country?
No. This time I was invited.
By whom?
This time I was invited by the publisher of the magazine. And this time was very different in general. Moscow has changed so much. People are talking. You can't get them to shut up anymore, which is wonderful. They've got 25, 30, 50 years of material they want to tell you. They want to tell you about their lives right now. They want to tell it to you in such a way as to make a commitment to speech so they can't roll glasnost and perestroika back. You are aware when you're there that things can be rolled back, and you're aware that courage is playing itself out in Moscow.
So what were some of the things that you did when you went back? This wasn't your first trip. You had gone to...
I went in 72, last time I was there. 16 years later, this year, I went back. When I was there in 73, pardon me. And the first time I was there, I was sort of operating on my own, and I would stand outside militia headquarters and secretively sketch the comings and goings of the officers in and out. This time I was led through the gate and taken, given a grand tour of the establishment, met the head of militia, went to the Ministry of the Interior, met the general in charge of criminal investigations throughout the country. It was a very different kind of reception.
I hope you took lots of notes and photographs and things.
I did. There are tourists and there are tourists. I'm always thinking ahead when I'm in the Soviet Union. I was very struck by not just the reception among the police, but the way crime itself had changed in the Soviet Union. I was given a different kind of tour of Moscow by a Moscow detective. It was funny. This man also happened to be a reader of American detective stories and private eye stories. And I said, what can a private eye story mean to you? I mean, here's somebody, you're part of the Soviet militia. Here's a private investigator who has no forensic backup. No logistical backup, and operates on his own on a shoestring. And he said, no, it's just like us. You've got a city of 9 million people there and 150 patrol cars. You've got somebody, a Moscow detective, who is responding to a crime over in, say, one part of town in his precinct, and then has to either go find a car, can't find a car. If he did find a car, he'd have to get some gas for the car. He won't have any luck doing that. Then he has to go to the metro and ride the metro to respond to the report. They're all gumshoes there. They're all operating on their own.
Now, did you follow him on his route?
Yeah.
What kind of crime did he investigate?
He was investigating corruption. Corruption is the big new crime in the Soviet Union. They've got all these cooperatives, and people starting up small businesses, often restaurants. And the Soviet criminals have come together, become organized into what they call mafias. The mafias have started out as our mafia started out, promising, first demanding extortion, and then promising protection. And some of the smarter mafiosos are, in fact, starting their own cooperatives, laundering money. This is an entirely new system of crime in the Soviet Union. New to them, old to us.
What about street crime?
Street crime has increased, too, but much of that is crime between gangs. About the most interesting street in Moscow is the Old Arbat, which is, if anybody goes to Moscow, that is the street they should visit, because it's full of musicians, full of artists, full of political harangues. It also has some cooperative restaurants where you can actually get something good to eat. But it also has gangs fighting each other, so it also has the most violence, a lot of the violence in Moscow. That's the picture of Moscow that every tourist should give himself.
So after Stalingrad, you started work on Polar Star. How did you realize that a boat like this existed?
I saw an article in my college alumni magazine, someone who had worked on a ship like this. And I'm not proud. I'll get my information absolutely anywhere. And inspiration can come from any direction. So I looked into, found out as much as I could about it, which was very little. There's been very little written about this joint venture. Many people believed it didn't exist.
Is this true?
Absolutely.
And there is a Polar Star?
Well, there is, in fact, a Soviet factory ship called the Polar Star. It's not the one I use. There is, in fact, the ship that I was on, which was the Sulak. That was not the ship I use. It's pretty much the ship I use, but I want to make clear here the events that take place in this book are fiction. There were no bodies in the polar on the Sulak that I was aware of. But the ship, the physical description is a very, I think, accurate description of a factory ship in the Bering Sea.
And there were both Americans and Soviets on the ship.
That's right.
Uh-huh. And where did you stay?
When I was on the ship, it was in port.
Uh-huh.
I didn't get to go fishing with the Soviets. I had a deal with the Soviet captain that I would, but unfortunately, on the way out to the fishing grounds, the Soviet embassy caught up with me. They had always been against my going up there.
Where was it in port?
In Dutch Harbor, in the Aleutian Islands.
Oh, it was in the Aleutians.
Yeah.
Well, they can't stop you, can you?
Oh,
that's
yes,
an American
they can.
Port.
Oh, they can't stop me from they can't stop me from going to Dutch Harbor, although they try to dissuade me. But they sure can't stop me from getting on a Soviet ship.
Mm.
They had been against having any American reporter come on the ship. The Soviet captain was an interesting man. He was a party man, of course, ambitious, smart, a leading captain. And he figured out who I was. He found an old American magazine in his cabin. At least this is one interpretation. This is one story of how he figured out or found out who I was. It was an old review with a picture of me with a name of this anti-Soviet writer underneath it. And so we had a long talk, the two of us, in which we talked about what it was to be anti-Soviet, whether it was accurate or not, what kind of a writer I was, what kind of a boat he was captain of, at the end of which he decided that he would trust me, and he wanted me to go sailing with him. I told him, I had to be honest with him, and tell him that the Soviet embassy had tried to dissuade me from doing this, there's no point in cutting the man off at the knees, but he wanted me to go fishing with him anyway. However, the Soviet embassy did get word of what was going on, probably from the political officer on board, and while we were steaming out to the fishing grounds away from port a day or so later, the word came down that I was not ever to get back on that ship.
Mm. It feels like you were on it for a long time, though. Your physical descriptions are so good.
Well, if you know this kind of situation, you go someplace, you're going to be there maybe 5 seconds, 5 minutes, or 5 hours. But you have to know this place intimately, and your eyes are open. You know situations. As a reporter, you go in, you are going to remember this room for the rest of your life.
Well, Arkady Rinko really fell out of grace, didn't he? Where, as the book opens, tell me where he is.
He's on the slime line. Now, that's a phrase. It's a phrase that's used by anybody in a factory ship like this. And it's called it for good reason, because as they process the fish, thousands of fish in an hour, 40 metric tons, 300 metric tons in a day, say. They're processing the fish, chopping it up, beheading it, gutting it, hosing it down. And, of course, what you've got a lot of the time is bottom fish, much of which has exploded on the way up to the top, up to the surface. So you have fish slime everywhere. And the last place any fisherman wants to work is the slime line. And that is where Arkady Rinko reappears. That's where, you know, you wonder if the reemergence of someone that you're very fond of, a heroic character, you always expect him to be seen on a hillside riding a horse. Not this time.
No, but of course there is the murder of the young woman. And am I mispronouncing Arkady?
Arkady.
Arkady.
Arkady Rinko.
Arkady. And I'm saying Arkady. All right, Arkady. Any rate, a murder. This is actually it turns into an old-fashioned mystery, doesn't it?
Well, it has. I like old-fashioned mysteries. On the other hand, I'm very bored by old-fashioned mysteries. To do an old-fashioned mystery just to do an old-fashioned mystery is a waste of time. It's a waste of time to me. To do an old-fashioned mystery and present that and then explode it with characters who come alive and give it the depth and dimension of real life and of the political tension of the Soviet Union just itself, let alone tension between the Soviet Union and the United States, that is to make something of it. That makes it worthwhile. But, it's taking the rules of this little old game of the mystery novel and giving it this enormous juice.
Yeah, it's so exciting. Your hero has so many close calls and narrow escapes in that refrigerator room, for example. You had to do a lot of research, though. Well, the autopsy room and the when he's in freezing to death, practically
yes.
freezing to death.
Yes.
I mean, that takes a lot of research, doesn't it?
It does.
To know what happens to people.
Yeah, well, it's always interesting. What would happen? What would you do if you found yourself in a fish locker, in the freezing fish locker? How would you get out if there was no one to, if in fact the door was being held shut? And you have to start thinking it through. What would you do? It's a little bit like the old Chuck Yeager routine. You're in the plane. It's spinning towards Earth, losing about a thousand feet a second. You go through plan A, plan B, plan C, in hopes that at least down to you get to plan F, something is going to work. It's an interesting way to do it when, in fact, your mind is starting to slow down because you're starting to freeze.
Well, we're not going to divulge how your hero gets out of that one. But the autopsy, this is something like out of Alien.
Yeah, yeah. Well, look, it's a book that's very serious in some ways, but I do like to have fun. And there should be some points where the reader suddenly sits up, sits all the way up, and stares at the book in some degree of disbelief or surprise.
But not at dinner time.
Not at dinner time. Okay.
Well, what's going to happen? Are you going to bring Arcadi back?
Well,
yes, I know you are. What's going to happen to him after Polar Star? You know, he emerges a hero. He's off the slime line, isn't he?
Obviously I didn't go to Moscow just to visit my rubles. I'm thinking about what would happen next. But if I don't, this is a curious situation in which you've got this character that I feel very fondly towards. Who helps me write, in fact, who helps me write well, or as best as I can. And I want to see him again, but I'm just not going to drag him out until there's the right story, yeah, the right answer to the end of this one.
There's probably a long gestation period, isn't there, where you think and think and think about what you're going to do and what is going to happen.
Yeah, you're directing your thoughts about what can I do next, what will happen next, when in fact the answer tends to come by itself. Like as this ship Polar Star came in by itself into my consciousness while I was thinking of something else. I think if Arkady Renko comes back again, as I hope he does, I suspect he'll be standing in front of me for some time before I realize it.
It takes a long time to write a book. This book had to be finished, say, like a year ago, right?
Well, no, I'm writing up to the last second. I was rewriting the reader's copy of this thing because I just hate to let go. Because I rewrite so much. I mean, the first page was written 10 to 20 times, more like 20 times. After I finished the end of the book, then I went back and rewrote the beginning again. In fact, I rewrote the beginning in the reader's copy.
They let you get away with that?
Nobody's happy about that kind of situation.
Don't they have to reset the plates and
yes,
all that?
Yeah. But I feel very reluctant to let go of anything that doesn't feel absolutely smooth. You know, you can disrupt the story to me at any point. As soon as the reader feels that this doesn't sound quite right, this sounds rough, this jars, you're pulling him out of the story, and you're starting to lose him, and you've got to get him back in. The whole thing really should read as a dream.
Yeah, it's such a subtle thing. You read a line, read a sentence, a paragraph, and it doesn't sound right, doesn't feel right, but you're not quite sure why. Isn't
yeah.
that true?
And you can even write a scene that's very striking, but it just doesn't fit with the rest of the book. Those are the hard scenes to let go of, the ones that are the ones that are striking by themselves. But sometimes they simply are not right. You have a character who seems entertaining, but he may be too entertaining. He may not be. He's supposed to be Soviet, but he really doesn't. On fifth reading, sound Soviet anymore. He just sounds what? He sounds too American. He sounds wrong. And then you've got to change him or drop him. And so that takes me forever. I don't mind taking another 6 months if I'm going to have a better book.
But at some point, you have to stop.
At some point, they come and take it away.
I would assume that you use a word processor. That probably really helps in the writing of a book, doesn't it?
Well, it's no help the first time through, but it sure is a help when you live on rewriting the way I do, because I just churn it out and do it again and do it again and do it again. And I can make those changes so rapidly on a word processor and print it out. I think you asked me the same question last time I was here with Stallion Gate, and I said I would never use a word processor. I was wedded to my Selectric 3. But in the meantime, things have changed, and I've gotten smarter, and I've moved into the 20th century, and so I do use the screen.
Well, it just eliminates so much drudgery.
Yeah. I used to sit surrounded. I looked like one of these cherry trees that had lost all its blossoms on the same day, surrounded with my little pieces of paper that were crumpled up. Now I just destroy it on the screen all the time, where I print out and I produce some paper that I crumple up that way, but 10% of what I used to throw away on paper before.
No, I think that you can make a better book by using word processor, because you might have a chapter. Within that chapter, some lines or a paragraph that may not be quite right, but it's such a chore to make those changes that maybe just let it go, you know.
Yes.
I have a feeling. I used to write with a manual typewriter and short stories and an unpublished novel on it, and I was looking at this novel the other day, and all of this white out and white tape.
Yes.
And every time I would sit down after an evening at the typewriter, pick up the manuscript and go through it, I'd find errors. And I would get up, go back to the typewriter,
yes.
and get the white out.
Yes.
In fact, my typewriter, the roller bar of my typewriter was just white. It was no longer black.
Yes.
What a mess.
When the manuscript pages start to feel like marble tablets, that's a sign. It's to start all over again. And I was like that. I had the white out, then I had the Selectric 3, all the time trying to generate that ease with which, you know, you can simply take out words here, words there. If you want to write well, you must, to some degree, accept the idea that you should, that you're going to rewrite everything two or three times. So I'm forced onto the screen that way.
Yeah. Well, what the machine do you use?
I use a PC. Mm-hmm. Almost anything would serve for me. I use a computer, a word processor, for the most primitive of tasks, which is to tell a story.
Telling a story is a primitive task?
For a computer, it's the easiest thing it does. It's not a spreadsheet. There are no, you know, great calculations to perform. There are no graphics, no charts. It's just somebody sitting down and punching in the words, changing them, and then finally coming out with 350 pages of printout.
You mentioned visiting your rubles in Russia. Have they paid you?
Yeah, they paid me in rubles.
But you can't take it out.
I can't take it out. So I visit. I am now the proud possessor of a Soviet savings account.
Maybe get a little apartment there.
No, well, not quite that much. Not quite that much. But this is something that has to be resolved with the Soviets.
They pay interest?
They don't like to pay hard currency.
They pay interest on the savings
account? Oh, 3%.
There you go.
3%. That'll keep you riding the metro for a year or two. Yeah. But we've got to get to the point where I was very pleased to be paid by the Soviets. They paid me well, but they paid me in rubles. I am lucky enough to be able to go visit the rubles. But when we get to having more Soviet writers writing here and American writers being published there, we have to demand that American writers be able to be paid in hard currency.
But if Random House publishes a Soviet writer, the Soviet writer would be paid.
Absolutely.
The check would be sent to
That's
him,
right.
Isn't that true? But it doesn't work the other way.
No, it doesn't. So there is some discrepancy here that has to be rectified soon.
Have you started a new project?
The Moscow visit could have been the start of a new project. I leave next week for Europe to do some more what will be research. In part, it can be said that I'm taking the coward's route and just leaving when the reviews are coming in. I like to think of it as an absolutely necessary trip.
to go to Europe.
Yeah. Well, of course, I could just go. I could go in a hole in the ground and do it that way too. The next story I think is going to take place in Europe. Yeah. Maybe. We'll see what Arkady wants to do.
So it will be Arkady.
I hope so. If it's not Arkady, I'm at a complete loss.
No, you're not. You keep writing and writing and writing, and it doesn't have to be on your Soviet hero.
No. The last one was Stalingate, which was a book I'm very fond of about the making of the atomic bomb at Los Alamos. And I've got some other ideas, but there's a question. There are some questions I have that I'd like to pursue, and just in terms of maybe it's the end of the Cold War that intrigues me right now. Who are the final victims of the end of the Cold War? Not the Cold War, but the end of it. And more than that, I refuse to say. In part because I don't want to talk too much about a project, and in part because I don't know any more about it.
Well, where do you live in California?
I live in Northern California, near San Francisco. Up to then, I lived in New York City.
Oh, when was that?
I moved I think it was 1980, 81. I moved to California.
Oh.
Up to then, I lived in the East Side.
What prompted you move to California?
We had two children, and then we had a third about 10 years after the second kid. We had a third, and we just refused to bring up a third kid in Central Park. Mm-hmm. I had, for the last time, dragged a blanket out to Central Park looking for a place to have a picnic. You know, I was tired of telling the kids not to sit there, don't sit there. There's the neck of an old wine bottle over there. Try over here, and on this little worn piece of the patch of dirt over there. I just wasn't going to do it a third time. The parent in me finally came out.
Yeah, it's complicated to raise children in Manhattan. There's mm-hmm. no question about that. But being you're a full-time writer. It gives you a lot of, you probably get a lot of kidding about this from your neighbors and friends. It gives you a lot of free time, huh?
Well, yeah, there's, actually, one of my favorite ideas about the way people perceive writing is that I used to work at a company that also employed Mario Puzo. And Mario Puzo's wife was once asked how she felt about him writing The Godfather. And she said, well, I know people say he wrote it, but I never saw him working. He was always sleeping on the couch whenever I saw him. So everybody has this perception of a writer as having an enormous amount of free time. In fact, I have a little office near the house that I go to at 9 in the morning. And at 5 o'clock, still pretending to be a normal person, I leave and come home. I used to be a guy who worked from 10 in the morning to 10 at night. And I finally realized it was crazy. I used to do that 7 days a week. And I didn't see anybody. I didn't see my own family. So I gave up on that and became normal, became sane.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think people do have a misperception. I wrote a novel that was published last year by St. Martin's Press, and I worked on this thing off and on weekends and nights, usually in the dining room.
Yes.
And before I got my computer, I did it on a manual typewriter. Mm-hmm. My kid was small, and he would sometimes come up and harass me.
Yes.
And my wife would say, "Don't bother Daddy while he's typing." And I'd be furious. I said,
yes.
"I'm not typing.
Yes.
I'm not typing."
Yes.
And when I got the computer, and this happened to be, we live in Manhattan, it was in the living room. I had to move the computer to the desk, which was kind of in the center of the living room, you know, near the television set. Not a very good place to work. But I would have my earphones on, and I'd be at the computer screen, and the kid would come up and playfully bother me, and my
yes.
wife would say, "Don't bother Daddy while he's playing with his computer."
Yes.
Then after I sold this book, my wife turned to me and said, "I didn't know you had written a book."
She sounds like a very patient wife to me.
Well,
I mean, if you really didn't think you were writing a book, and you really thought you were playing with the computer, then you have a...
you see someone behind a computer screen, you don't know what the hell they're doing.
Yeah, yeah.
You look in our newsroom, you see all sorts of people looking in the computer screen. I wonder what they're doing, because some of them aren't assigned to write shows,
yes.
they're not doing scripts,
yes.
but they look busy.
Yeah. Maybe they're all writers, and they all have their manuscripts
working
up
on their
that.
Victorian
yes.
novels.
Yes, yes.
Well, Martin Cruz Smith, Polar Star, it's a terrific book, sequel to Gorky Park. Thank you very much.
Thank you.